Greetings, Raise community. Brent coming in live with today's guest, Sergio Gonzalez, who serves as Senior Vice President for Advancement at my alma mater, Brown University, and he also serves as Chair of the Case Board of Trustees. Welcome, Sergio.
Thank you, Brent. It's a pleasure to be here with you, and congratulations to you on all the success, recent successes you've had. And as I mentioned to you earlier, we're very proud of you as an alum.
Well, thank you. And I'm grateful to have you leading the charge for Brown in this important role and really look forward to discussing that. But before we get there, I want to know more about your career path. And my understanding is that it is quite different than many of the leaders that we've featured here on the Raise podcast. In countless situations, we've had a conversation that goes along the lines of, I went to X for college, I became a student caller, that introduced me to this world, one thing led to another, and now I'm on your podcast. Different path for you. So take me back to junior year of high school. Who was that Sergio? What was he into? Where were you? And what led you to Georgetown University?
It's interesting. So that Sergio was somebody who's interested in the global world and international relations and really much public affairs and government and policy. And as a result, I had gone to a high school, Jesuit high school, Belen Jesuit, that actually has existed for many years. It started in Cuba and moved over after the revolution in 1960 over to Miami. And so I graduated from there and went to Georgetown. I went to the Foreign Service School at Georgetown, again, pursuing my international interests, international relations, diplomacy, all those kind of things, thinking that that's the career I was going to follow. And as life has it, and in part, I think because of my exile or immigrant family that wanted me to, you know, the perspective of being a professional, that in some ways drove me to go to law school. And I went to law school. I went to Columbia and to law school and graduated from there and eventually and ended up practicing law back in Miami at several law firms. So that was my early career trajectory. And I moved away from, that international global area, at least in my profession, to more of a legal career in litigation.
Yeah, not too many people can say they went to high school that was founded by the Queen of Spain, if my research serves me. So that was pretty unique.
Yeah, it's a great school, and you know, the biggest takeaway for me, which I think has been part of my life, is that concept of men and women for others. You know, the concept of giving back, and whatever way you do, whatever your life is, you give back, and that was kind of ingrained in me and most students that go to that school, including my son who graduated eventually. You know. Many years later from the high school as well.
So what kind of law were you practicing? Tell me about some of the most memorable experiences when you're back in South Florida.
So I was a commercial litigator, and worked at a couple of law firms and realized early on that, you know, I wanted to do something and that my skill sets probably also not only my interests, but my skill sets were more aligned with leading organizations and you know, creating teams and that kind of work. And that's what led me away from the practice of law early on. Had a mentor who was a county commissioner at the time, and that led me into local government and did a number of things over 9 years in local government. I oversaw homelessness, created a whole continuum of care, initially being the first executive director, an agency we created, and then sharing that organization for a number of years. And that was something that I, you know, really truly enjoyed and was proud of. Created a model that became a national model for continuum of care addressing homelessness. So ran that organization, eventually had a couple of other shorter stints in government as a senior executive. I oversaw, became the director of the Super Bowl host committee. As a lone executive from county government. So I ran that. And then eventually became the chief.
Can I ask, was that Super Bowl? Which Super Bowl was that?
30? That was the 99 game, as I recall.
Super Bowl 33. I got to say, that was kind of one of the best family vacations we ever took, actually.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's great.
My parents after they both grew up in Iowa, but they moved to Fort Lauderdale for 7 years after they got married. And that's where I was born. And so I was like the only Dolphins fan in Northeast Iowa growing up. And so in 99 or whatever, maybe it was 98, but it was Super Bowl 33, which was John Elway's last game. They took us on a family trip back to South Florida. So thank you for your good
Wow,
work.
that's very well. The other thing we share is being huge Dolphins fans. I hope you still are. I certainly am. So I'm a
Well,
fan of teams.
after you know, more than a decade in New England, it was hard to you know, hard to proudly rep the Dolphins, but I'm glad you've stayed strong for sure.
Yeah, I know. I definitely have, and that's one thing. Enjoy living in New England and following all the Miami teams. But so anyway, so back to the.
But if you're, so let me just ask, because if you're doing work around homelessness, for example, you must have started to intersect with philanthropy or philanthropists, or like, at what point did that intersection of nonprofit and government start to get on your radar?
Well, somewhat at that point, certainly when I was directing the Super Bowl host committee, there were sponsorships was a significant part of what we did and developing funding for the activities of the host committee. So that was one early connection to philanthropy. On the homeless side, similarly, we had a private sector partner that had a fundraising goal and aim, and I was somewhat involved in that. But really, most of our funding came from government. We had the first dedicated source of funding for homelessness in the country, which was a food and beverage tax at the time. And the federal governments, when we were designated as a model homeless community, we received significant funding from the federal government for that. So those were my first forays, if you will, into garnering resources and fundraising. But I didn't think of myself as a fundraiser. I was more than anything else, I was leading, creating these organizations, leading them, and making sure that you know, they were performing. So that was, but there was a bit of fundraising, to your point. And then after the Super Bowl host committee, I was became the chief of staff for the mayor at that time and Miami-Dade County. And I did that for 4 years. And that's where I was when I first got into higher education. I can explain how that is. As you mentioned, it was a non-traditional track for sure.
Yeah. Tell me about it. And ultimately, you had an amazing run at Miami, and I want to hear about just the you and the branding and all the work around that as well.
Yeah, so I was, as I mentioned, chief of staff for the mayor at the time. It was an interesting time in South Florida. And Donna Shalala, former secretary of HHS, former chancellor, president of several universities, got appointed president of the University of Miami. Did not know her, but some folks in the community knew of me and my work and knew what she was looking for, which was somebody to oversee her external affairs at the University of Miami in a senior role reporting to her. And, you know, that included fundraising, development, alumni relations, and included communications for the entire university and government relations. And, you know, I was lucky. I met her and she offered me the job and I made the jump. So I was very non-traditional. I had never really fundraised in a formal way. I had not worked in higher education. And here I was leading a team of, you know, over 200, 250 folks to do this function. And fast forward, you know, I spent 16 years at the university, 14 years working with Donna, who is an amazing leader and a great friend and just amazing person. And then I worked for 2.5 years with subsequent president, Julio Frank, who has been a good leader for the university, still leading the university. So it was really a privilege and a tribute. It was a great opportunity, and you know, I was very engaged in the community, so I continue to serve on boards and serve the community in different ways.
So take me back to your first year, and there are so many acronyms and you know, functions to learn about that you know, we take for granted. Once you've spent some time in the advancement sector, that at the time must have felt pretty foreign. If you could go back to that first year and give yourself advice or share a perspective that would have been helpful to you then as you were ramping up into this space, what might stand out? Anything you wish you knew then that you know now?
Well, I hadn't thought about it in retrospect. I can tell you what some of the things that I think that pulled me through that time, and I still, are a core to the way that I work. And that is, first of all, a certain sense of humility, but with confidence, right? That's the I always talk now. I mentor a lot. I've mentored over the years many folks who, in different career tracks, and I say, you got to be confident in your skills and abilities, but you have to do it with a certain element of humility about what you know or don't know or what may happen that just may come at you. If you get that right combination, I think that's good for a leader. So I think that that was never crossing the line into arrogance. By the way, the moment you cross that line into arrogance, you start coming down because you don't even know it, but folks are really not pulling your with you, but they're pulling against you. So that is a critical, and that helped me in those early years because I had to learn, you mentioned acronyms, I had to learn the business itself. I mean, I certainly had the instincts about, and I had run organizations, I had led teams. So that I had done and managed teams, but more the day-to-day work of fundraising and development. And alumni relations I had to learn. And I simply tried to immerse myself in it and eventually it took me a good 5 to 6 months to get all the terms down and get a good sense of what I needed to do. And then from there I went on. And then eventually I used to get asked a lot about my non-traditional way of getting into higher ed and whether that's, doable for others and how best to do it and all those kind of things. But, eternally grateful to Donna Shalala who gave me that first opportunity. But it's also, I think, if anything, for listeners or anybody who's listening to this, I would encourage them to, feel confident in your abilities because we all have transferable skill sets that translate into other organizations and other types of jobs. And all you need really is somebody to give you the chance. And then there's the skills as a leader that you need to have to be able to execute.
And how much of your work, given that you didn't sort of grow up as the annual fund person that became the major gift officer that led the development team that became the SVP, how much of the core development work did you personally need to learn or execute? I mean, how much of
Yeah.
job was chief fundraiser versus leader of an operation?
It was a combination. I recognized early on that in my role, and this has been the case ever since, in my over 25 years in the profession now, you have to be the lead chief fundraiser strategist. You have to develop your own relationships with the appropriate folks. You have to solicit, you have to close gifts. So all that you had to do. And I, started doing that immediately in Miami. Most of the trustees of the university were folks who I had the primary relationship with. Working with somebody on the principal gift side with me. So I had that. And on the rest of the leading the team and management, you have to spend the time. I think one of the and after talking for many years and certainly through my leadership role at Case, talking to many leaders, that's the one issue for senior vice presidents or heads of development is what percentage of your time can you spend building relationships, closing gifts with donors, and key alumni leaders, as opposed to the time you need to manage and lead an operation. The formula for me, it worked back then and it works now, is hiring and retaining very talented individuals. And also that it's not about me. This is a team sport, if you will. Teamwork is critical, collaboration is critical, and hiring people who are just who are better than, frankly, you. That's you hear this from leaders at many of these roles and can specialize in those roles and you can trust them, but also be there for them in helping them make decisions. That's the formula. And the more talented and folks you have on your team, and the more leaders you have on your team, the better you're going to be as an organization. The better your metrics are going to be. The more funds you're going to raise. The better engagement you're going to do.
When you think about your time at Miami, tell me about some of your most poignant memories, whether they were great experiences or maybe the trip that just couldn't have gone worse. I mean, anything stand out among those years?
Well, I'll tell you, the first memory I had was just, I wasn't even officially on the job. It was some relatively short time after 9/11. and it was going to the Rose Bowl, where Miami was playing for the national championship against Nebraska, and seeing the University of Miami fan base and the passion that existed, and having Miami, you know, hit that climate and that and winning the national championship at a time which was very challenging for our country, still is one of the first large sporting events after 9/11. So security and other things were, you know, were of primary concern. But that was one of my first. It was just, and it was really the beginning of what I saw over my 16 years at UM, is the passion that folks have at U, alumni and others in the South Florida community, particularly for the University of Miami, not only in sports, but overall, what it's, how meaningful that institution is to the broader community in so many ways. That was one memory, certainly many memories with President Shalala of times that we spent together, whether New Year's Eve, you know, together and football games or just traveling and things of that nature were very important. And of course, you know, we had two very successful billion plus campaigns, and those many memories around that, many memories of many colleagues working with colleagues who were terrific, who were friends, who did amazing work, the dedication of the advancement team for the University of Miami that made it successful was where my most wonderful memories lie.
You mentioned President Shalala several times, and I know you have worked very closely with President Paxson at Brown. When you think about the ideal sort of relationship or the orchestration of what the president can do to support fundraising, what you as the leader can do, and what the principal gift officer can do. Tell me more about that dynamic, sure, sort of individual donor relationship. Like, we're talking about those top 25, top 50 relationships. What does the president do? What do you do? What does the principal gift team do? And then obviously their stewardship and supporting infrastructure as well.
Absolutely. And that's an important, very important question for when you lead with any fundraising operation. You know, I you mentioned President Paxson. I've been blessed and lucky to work for two presidents who had just been who are amazing leaders. Chris Paxson is just incredible in so many different ways. You know, she's just an incredible leader and an incredible leader in our space as well. So I've been lucky to work for two incredible presidents, incredible leaders. But to your point, when I speak to now to groups and at case events and all, one of the first things I say, even globally, is, and this runs the gamut, not only in higher education, but in nonprofits and independent schools. You know, one of the most important metrics of success, or indicators of success, I should say, for a fundraising operation is the level of engagement, the level of importance, and how directly involved the leader of an organization is with the fundraising and engagement functions. The prioritization of the function by the president. And in higher education, we know that boards and presidents do prioritize it, have to prioritize it. It's more and more part of their jobs. But that's not necessarily the case in other parts of the world. You know, CASE is a global organization. I spent a lot of time traveling with the great CEO, Sue Cunningham. That's not the case in different parts of the world, where, you know, the presidents see the rectors, as they're called in some, or chancellors, how they don't necessarily see or have as part of their job fundraising as the, you know, almost at the top, like university presidents do in higher education and heads of schools and independent schools have in the States. That is critical. That is so important. And you asked more specifically, so what is that? What is it that they do, and how important? So, you know, certainly with the relationships that require deepening, and the relationships of donors and alums, alumni leaders who are very engaged with the university, it's important for the presidents or the heads of schools to be very engaged with these individuals and be engaged not only on the fundraising side, but to really engage them on a pretty regular basis in a lot of the big picture decision making and some of the big issues relating to the university or the school, having those kind of relationships in some ways like personal relationships, creating certainly the line between management, never crossing that line, but making folks feel part and really listening to them. And that is a critical part of, and a very important part. And then the solicitation part as well. So there's usually to again, back to your specifics on your question, there's usually a number of donors and supporters of the institutions that have that kind of relationship, or the president should have that kind of relationship with. And many times the solicitations or whatever asked for support of any kind is usually done by the president in some of those instances. And usually if the president feels comfortable doing it and asking specifically for what we may need or want, that's usually more effective. So, but then my role and others on my senior team are to support the president in that, either by staffing her or providing guidance or strategy. That's usually how it works. And then there are relationships that we as senior vice presidents have that are our primary relationships as well. But engaging other academic leaders is important.
And so take us into some of those meeting rooms, obviously keeping specific donor confidentiality in mind, but who's at the table? I mean, literally who is sitting there on the, with the donor is there, but who else might they have at the table? I'm talking about at the most principal level type conversations. Who is at the table, from the university side? You just mentioned faculty or deans. I mean, who is in the room when the actual ask is being delivered?
Well, it depends on there isn't one specific formula because every donor or every alum is very different in their interest and engagement, right? Certainly if this is a relationship which the president has had or has developed, certainly the president would be part of the meeting where, there's a conversation about what the needs are, what the desire for the support is. Usually that would be staffed, sometimes not, by somebody senior on our team, whether it's myself or somebody else. That's usually the formula for somebody who the president has the primary relationship. In some cases, it is the provost who has that as a senior academic leader at the institution. In some cases, it's the dean who have those relationships. So depending on, again, the relationship, what we're asking the person to support or engage in, we will bring somebody into the conversation that is the primary person that can speak to that and can speak to the impact that, that contribution or support, or that support would have. So it depends on any given case. You really want to have at the table somebody who is most conducive to not only making the case for the support, but also being able to answer questions or concerns that the donor may have. So that's usually when you get to the point of a solicitation, that's what you're thinking about is who is, those are the considerations about who is around the table.
Tell me about your move to Brown, to Providence, like having South Florida be such an important part of your life and your relationships. That was a very big move. And I'm sure, cultural differences, differences in history of the institution. What was it like in the first 6 months or year? Was it sort of a seamless transition or was it a really challenging adjustment period?
Yeah, it's funny. That's a question that I still to this day, I've been in Providence now. My family and I have been here for 7 years and I still get that question, right? I think a lot of folks never thought that I'd leave Miami because I was so engaged in the community throughout different organizations, boards, all these things. And it came to the point that I got a call from Chris Paxson. I got a sense of what a terrific leader and somebody who I could really connect with. My daughter had gone to Brown, but she was about to graduate. So I did have that connection to Brown, but we made the decision based on, an opportunity to come and work with Chris and her leadership team, but also to come to a place where I thought I could really make a difference. It was tough leaving family, friends, and the Miami community. I grew up there and it's always, Miami will always be in my heart, but this was an opportunity to really make a difference. And we've loved Providence. Providence is a wonderful community. My family and I really loved it. It's you know, we've tried to get engaged in the community as much as we could, as we usually do wherever we are. And Brown is just a very special place, a very special institution. And, you know, everything that I thought why I was coming here has come through. Not only Chris and her amazing leadership, but just the institution and what it stands for and the opportunity that it provides students that may otherwise not have that opportunity. And as you know, Brent, the open curriculum and the ability for students to explore and explore careers and different interests in life and open their horizons. That's just very special at Brown. So the ethos here is something we very, very much love. And it's just been great. It's been colder. You know, I'm a runner, and it's, you know, on days like today, I go out there with layers, where in Miami, I wouldn't have had that. So that's a big difference. But we enjoy the change of seasons. We love the community and love Brown.
I don't have as much knowledge of this, but it has seemed like over the last decade that the sort of intersection of Providence and Brown has continued to grow. A lot of the investment that Brown has made has certainly played a role in revitalizing parts of Providence. I know that can be a tense relationship at times as well, but how much do you draw upon your historical work as it relates to civic engagement? You know, having worked in a mayor's office, does that come in handy when you're sort of navigating some of those considerations? And, you know, obviously feel free, whatever you're comfortable sharing.
Sure, no. And, you know, so Brown is lucky to have some very talented colleagues of mine that oversee the relationship with the city. Folks who are doing amazing work in that regard. So that's not my direct responsibility. However, wherever possible, either through my own personal engagements in different organizations in town, or whenever I have an opportunity to provide some input, I will do that based on my past experiences, having overseen this area in Miami for many years. But I will say that, you know, as you referenced, it's not only at Brown, but many institutions have some challenges and are not on the same page with respect to communities. Communities always expecting more from institutions. That's something that exists. I'm so happy to see the many ways that folks in the community are not even aware. They may have no reason to be aware in some cases, that Brown contributes and supports the broader Providence community, whether it's in the education space where there's great need in Providence, particularly public school system, whether it's just supporting a number of nonprofits in the community. Our president, Chris Paxson, has made it a priority, our community relations, in so many different ways. I could go on and on about the things that Brown does, many which are not visible, but I can tell you there's a true commitment to partnering with the community and supporting the community. Part of the challenge sometimes is finding the way, where and how to support in the most meaningful and impactful way, because there are many different processes and systems and places where Brown can contribute in the broader community. But we're trying to do that in so many different ways.
Even the advancement building, I mean, the office where you all are, you know, it's just been an amazing addition to.
And I'm glad you mentioned that, because this is for those who are familiar with Providence, this is the jewelry, well, it's been called the jewelry district, and it's across the river from the main part of campus. And Brown has been expanding into this area, which from an economic development perspective for the city, I think is a great thing, and certainly a great thing for Brown as well, as we expand here. Particularly our health and research platform here will continue to expand in this area. And our offices are on this side, as you referenced. Yeah.
Tell me about your history with CASE, you know, to go from kind of an atypical entrance into the sector to being chair of the board really stands out. Your day job is a big job. Being chair of the CASE board is a big job. Those are obviously symbiotic in many ways, but just tell me about your history with CASE and at which point you felt like, at what point you really felt inspired to lean into that organization as sort of an outlet for, you know, your sort of both personal time, but also professional time.
Sure. Thank you for that question. When I first started, and we referenced that before, I was a non-traditional candidate. I had to learn the nomenclature. I had to learn all these basic concepts, the first thing I turned to was CASE. And I went to a couple of conferences. And from there, I got my head, you know, kind of in the box of a lot of this, the language and the concepts and all these things. And CASE helped me tremendously just by going to, you know, a senior, you know, vice president conference in that regard and some other things as well. So that that was my first introduction to CASE. And then about 4 or 5 years after that, when I was already ingrained in the job, really had had been in it for a while, I went in and just I said, this is the primary organization in our profession. It is a global organization. It does so much for folks. I need to, you know, in my history of engagement, which I referenced earlier in community and different things, I need to be engaged. I need to get back in some ways. So I had a meeting. I just asked for a meeting with the CEO at the time and asked him, listen, I'm here. You know, I have this background. I would love to support and help the organization in which way. And that started my now 15, 17 year trajectory in leadership roles at CASE, particularly at the central level, sitting on their a commission of philanthropy. I've chaired their U.S. CASE Canada board, and then sitting on the board. I think now I'm been on the board for 11 or 12 years, if not more, and being the chair for this is my second year of a 2-year term as chair of the board. It's an incredible organization representing over 90,000 individual members across the globe. It is an organization that is the primary membership organization and training ground for professionals in the alumni relations, development, and communications role. We have thousands of members in member institutions as well. We span from higher education, independent schools, community colleges all over the world. And we have a terrific president and CEO, Sue Cunningham, who I referenced earlier, worked very closely with her and a great board to really expand and enhance and support our profession. In the United States, we have, incredible membership, but we're also growing it globally. And that is very interesting how, you know, the profession and many of our folks in the States and our profession, advancement profession are not, maybe as aware of how the profession has evolved in different parts of the world. And it's fascinating. I encourage folks to get involved with CASE and to give back. And also you get a lot from it. So that's been my trajectory.
And what do you hope, you know, when you think about the topics at board meetings right now and conversations with Sue, in 5 years, you know, what do you hope you can say about CASE that maybe you can't today? Where do you hope collectively as a board to be able to take the organization? How do you balance domestic focus and engagement versus the global growth? Just what are the headlines around the vision for CASE?
Sure. And we have a strategic plan with different elements of it. But at the bottom line is we're a membership organization, and serving our members and the value proposition around that is key and foremost. Whether it's somebody who's listening in here, who has gone to a conference, who listens to a CASE podcast, who actually, reads CASE Currents, which are whatever the case may be, the numerous ways that we provide training, we provide information, we support our profession, continuing to enhance that is first and foremost. So that is certainly the number one. And then there's a number of issues and emerging issues in our advancement and certainly in higher education that we're very cognizant of. We continue to be a thought leader as issues and challenging issues, frankly, arise. We are also a thought leader in supporting our profession globally as it faces challenges from governments in different ways or government policies. That's something else we do. We've been very active in the DEIB space and making sure and ensuring supporting our organizations who are pursuing diversity, equity and inclusion, and across the globe, because that means different things across the globe in different regions. So that is something we're very the educational component of what we do. I will say that even beyond CASE, we're very cognizant of the value proposition and how of higher education in particular, even independent schools, and the importance of educating the broader community and the country and countries, because it's a global issue, about the importance and the value proposition of higher education. That's something that we're very focused on as well at CAICE, but also outside of CAICE. I know in higher education, our leaders are very focused in that regard as well. And as far as the question about global and domestic, that is something that we are a global organization. So, one of the things we're focused on is what does that mean on a day-to-day basis as we enhance our global footprint, the balance between serving our domestic members and serving our global members. And it means something very different parts of the world. In some cases, it's producing materials in a different language. In other cases, it's really understanding the fabric of the maturity of the advancement or operations in different parts of the world, and being able to serve them appropriately because it may be very different from country to country. It's very interesting, but we are on that path. And currently we even have a task force who's analyzing that. What is the next step for us as a global organization?
Well, I will say that we certainly wouldn't be here without CAICE in many regards. I actually met my original co-founder for Evertrue at a CAICE conference in Chicago in January of 2011, maybe 2010, I'm forgetting now. But an amazing way to bring people together around this shared interest in the world of higher education and advancement. And certainly as a kind of longtime vendor partner, we can trace many specific inflection points in our business directly back to people that we've gotten to know by way of CAICE.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, Brent, one thought that I had as you were saying that, because your work, certainly the work of CAICE, the work of everyone who may be listening to you, to us today, who works in advancement, what motivates me the most, and I hope one message out of this about our advancement profession, that not everybody knows it well, right? There's so much more awareness to be had about what we do, including at many of our institutions, is that no matter what we do in advancement, whether you're backroom operations, advancement services, whether you're advancement communication, whatever we do, we're impacting lives and we're transforming lives in many cases at whatever institution we are. And that is an incredibly motivating factor. And I talk to a lot of younger folks and folks who are, entering or considering entering into the profession or advancing into it. And I say, listen, at some point of your life, if you're not there yet, you're gonna look back or you're gonna say impacting lives and transforming lives is an incredibly worthwhile activity when you get to do it on a daily basis or support an institution in whatever way you're responsible for in transforming and impacting lives. And there's no better case than that in the engagement. You see it in the engagement of our alums and giving back to our students, the financial aid that we support, professorships that are raised, you name it, I can go down the list. And the work that you do, Brent, in supporting our institutions and doing it better and engaging better is also impacting lives in very significant ways. So I just wanted to get that message out there. I think it's obvious to many, but it's something that a reminder is always good.
No, I agree. And I think one of the biggest issues in this sector is there's such a focus on the millions and billions that you can lose the human impact story and all of the individual stories that go into the millions and billions raised or how that money is invested. And I know that's a constant challenge of how do you tell the individual story and then help, reinforce that at scale, because there is so many negative headlines about higher education, people questioning higher education. Yet so often when you talk to people about their experience, the mentor, the professor that pushed them in the right direction, we're talking government engagement the other, just a few minutes ago, Al Dahlberg, who's somebody that you've spent a bunch of time with, his dad was my first mentor, literally would go to his office and he would just give me that pep talk and help me feel like I belonged as a first generation college student. And there are just countless versions of that story that I think need to be elevated to help combat the negative headlines that are not reflective of reality for so many.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right. And it's important. We just got to stay at it and continue to communicate. Yep, absolutely.
So when times are tough, or you're having a rough week or a big issue, One of the great things about CASE is you do build relationships with people who are peers that are navigating a lot of the same themes and issues. Who's on your short list? Who are you texting? You don't need to tell me what you're texting them about, but who are some of the people that you've come to really confide in as peers in the CASE community?
In the CASE community, a lot of them are my counterparts at other institutions who have similar experiences. So without naming names, but, you know, folks who I know go through some of the same things. We also have an Ivy Plus group. So like every institution, you know, most institutions have groups of professionals that they get together and talk to. And, you know, I will, you know, that's another group for me that is helpful to hear and have experiences with. But the other folks for me are, frankly, my colleagues, the folks that I work with. I develop deep relationships with people who I work with, professional relationships, and I trust them tremendously. That's, you know, my story is hiring, you know, I mentioned it earlier, hiring amazing people that become, very, I trust, and who I not only trust them, but trust their opinions, their thought leadership. And when there are tough issues, you know, sharing information and getting their thoughts. I, you know, part of leadership this day and age, you know, I talk a lot about leadership and the qualities. I'm asked to talk about that. I would have not there today. I talk about certain qualities that were not probably at the top of my list prior to the pandemic and maybe 5 years ago. More than ever today, as leaders, whether it's in higher education and the corporate sector, I think that being reflective, being a listener, a good listener, and then providing feedback on decision-making is critical and crucial. You know, the workplace, the folks that we engage with externally, we need to, you know, there are more perspective and stronger perspectives around a number of different things that as a leader, you have to check your own instincts on things and really listen to others' perspectives and then reflect. And then upon reflection, making decisions. And not be afraid to make decisions. But that is a critically important quality. And back to your question, you know, there are a number of my colleagues, senior colleagues at the institution, particularly in advancement, that I trust and that we make decisions. You know, my decisions are informed by different perspectives, even more than ever this day and age.
Well, that's a good segue to the last topic. Tell me about what's going on at Brown. According to brown.edu, $3.922 billion raised out of a $4 billion campaign extension goal for Brown Together. Tell me about that. The team, are you hiring? And I want people to be able to stay in touch with you after this.
Yeah, absolutely. And I encourage folks to you know, I'm happy, always happy to respond to folks in the profession or anybody I can help or in any way. You know, very exciting times at your alma mater at Brown. You know, it starts with great leadership of Chris. Yes, we've had incredible success with this campaign. Gratitude, you know, is one of the themes because we're so grateful to all our donors and all our supporters who have, you know, really made Brown a priority in their giving and really stretched in their giving back. And those who are alumni leaders who are engaged, it's just been terrific. There's so many highlights. The numbers are big. You know, it was a $3 billion campaign. We hit it early. We extended that to 4 billion. But you know what I like to talk about, and I say this often, is not only the numbers people get excited about, and it's all great, but it's what are those dollars really doing for the institution and for the lives we serve, right? And you know, the many themes out of this campaign. One of them is financial aid and accessibility for students at Brown. You know, we've become need blind for international students. We did away with loans in this campaign. We did away with home equity and student financial aid packages as a consideration. I could go on and on about accessibility and what we've done in that regard. Veteran students, we've doubled the number of veteran students with financial aid support. So financial aid fundraising has been amazing. It's been it'll be a great legacy and impact, very impactful. Similarly, we've raised over 130 chairs, and that just allows us to retain and recruit amazing faculty. Many of them come from diverse backgrounds or diverse themselves, and has just really brought just a whole different level of opportunities for Brown in that regard as well. I could go on with the campaign, but just the impact on people, on the institution overall, the increase in the endowment, Just terrific. And you know, it's just a privilege and an honor to be part of it, to be able to see the impact of the generosity of thousands of folks. So are we hiring? Yeah, we do hire. We hire. One of the things I take great pride in is retention and having a team that really works well together. I always say, you know, the end goal, the metrics, the numbers, that's great. But if it's the way we do our work, and that is inclusiveness, being transparent, you know, really making sure our team feels good. And that's helped us with retention. We've been able to knock on whatever, been able to retain folks and recruit some really talented folks to Brown that are part of our ethos and are part of our culture, which is, you know, frankly, being good to each other and having a workplace where people feel good and being included. So that's what's going on. I could go on for a long time on what's going on at Brown, but thank you for the opportunity for that.
Thank you for sharing. And as we conclude here, I was maybe going to ask you this at the beginning. I saved it for the end. Tell me about your grandfather. Work hard. Most everything will fall in place. Just sounds like a really inspiring guy, but let's close on his impact.
I didn't realize you were going to ask this question. This will get me emotional. Yeah, my grandfather was a very important. You probably saw that I was interviewed somewhere else. I remember a while ago, and I mentioned my grandfather. He was a very important influence on me. He was an immigrant. He came to this country as a political exile from Cuba in 1960. A man who worked very hard in his 50s had to come in, or early 50s had to come to this country because everything was taken away from him because, you know, of a dictatorship, and he fled to be in a democratic country and give his family a better opportunity. The story of many immigrants and exiles in this country. And, you know, he was a man who was, you know, true to his values, really a great family man, a gentleman, and somebody who really inspired me. And, you know, people ask me, what motivates you? Certainly, you know, I've talked about that today, impacting lives and making a difference for others and building teams and seeing people in our teams grow. Those are the things I really love. But at the end of the day, what drives me is this, you know, my family gave so much, including my mom and others working two jobs for me. You know, I was a financial aid kid. And for this family who did so much to give me these opportunities, I can't stop. You know, I got to work as hard as I can, do the best I can by them all the time. And, you know, there's always a sense of vulnerability. You can't fall back. You have to work hard and do your best to really succeed at whatever you're doing. So there's no question on that. And that I got from my grandfather, among many other things. So, you know, proud to be a Cuban American, that's for sure.
Absolutely. And different background and story that have led us to the same place, but could not feel more aligned with everything you just said. And I'm grateful for your time today, for your willingness to share your story, and look forward to continuing to get to know you, and would encourage people that are listening, you know, get involved with CASE. If you see Sergio at the conference, swing by, say hello, maybe share something that you heard on the podcast. But, you know, thank you for your service, and I look forward to continue to be in touch, Sergio.
Thank you, Brent. Thank you for all you do and for your service. Appreciate what you do and appreciate you. Thank you.
Thanks, all. With that, I'm going to wrap today's episode featuring Sergio Gonzalez, who serves as the Senior Vice President for Advancement at Brown University and Chair of the CASE Board of Trustees. Thanks, Sergio, and take care, everybody.